If you would open up to Matthew chapter 19, Matthew chapter 19. I want you to remember where we've been. And I want you to also to remember, as you read through your New Testament, understand there were no chapter breaks in the original writings. I mean, you imagine sitting down with the Gospel of Matthew and it literally just being one paragraph after another, after another, after another. And I'm not even so sure there were paragraphs, just the idea of text as it just keeps on coming, and long scrolls to be able to hold these things together. I know I fall into this rut from time to time where sometimes reading, you read a chapter, you read two chapters, and you find it beneficial to read almost half of the previous chapter to understand the next chapter. Now, you look at chapter 19, and it's going to be a question of the Pharisees about, is it always okay to send your wife away? And I want you to think about where the Spirit of God put chapter 19. Because where have we just been at the end of chapter 18? What context and what principles have we just been looking at? Forgiveness. Do you think that's any coincidence whatsoever? When you stop and really take that in, to go, if we're talking about marriage, he says, you need to understand one principle for sure, that forgiveness matters. And to think in these terms of what's in chapter 18, here is a man who owed a debt of 10,000 talents, the equivalent of 150,000 years of what it would take to pay off that debt. And yet because he is unwilling to forgive another slave who owes him 100 denarii, something that could be made in 100 days of work, what's the outcome for the first slave who owed 10,000 talents? The king is angry with him, and he takes him as well as his family, wife and children, and they are thrown into debtor's prison. And you realize how monumental is forgiveness in the kingdom of God. If we're an unforgiving people, where's it going to leave us in relationship with God? We will be outcasts. We will not enjoy fellowship with him. Now, another thing before we move forward with chapter 19, and this is not a trick question. I'm not aiming it to be that way. I could change the terminology to make it a trick question, but I'm not. When does the new covenant begin? Now, sometimes I know we do say death, but if you remember 1 Corinthians 15, without a resurrection, how good's the death? So you think, okay, we know we're at least at the resurrection of Jesus when the new covenant begins. You could even go another 47 days later to Pentecost. I want to say Pentecost, but I'm okay if somebody thinks resurrection. I think it fits somewhere in there, either of which we're after that. So we get to enjoy this new covenant relationship. Karen. That's a good way to put it. You know for sure it's in place by Pentecost, and you know that it's been paid for in terms of resurrection. So when you start to look at that, we run into the gospel accounts of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And to go, the things that are in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are they under the new covenant or the old covenant? Old covenant. Now, the tricky way to ask that question would have been, are we under the New Testament or the Old Testament? And Testament and Covenant are the same principle, the same ideas. But going, it's so hard when you start looking at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and we go, are they in the New Testament or the Old Testament? And we go, well, my Bible has them in the New Testament. You're correct. But where do they fit under covenant? Under the old. And that's what makes the life of Christ so amazing. We saw it in chapter 18. Does he sometimes teach things that are about church relationship? He does. And whenever he is, what kind of terminology does he use? He actually says church. in chapter 18, right? When he deals with if a brother has sinned and they're not going to change after one or two more witnesses go with person, then you take it before for the church, before the assembly. And so now understand what we have in chapter 18. We've just come off of talking about forgiveness. And could it be more plain and more clear after seeing what the king, what Jesus is telling them? Then you come here to chapter 19 and notice what gets laid out here. And we're going to make sure as we go through this, understand too, we're going to deal with the question they ask. We're not going to deal with every question we can conceive of. But at the same time, to see here, Jesus is answering a question. And we're going to make sure that we can see the application here. We can see the application way back in Genesis, which is what Jesus is going to bring up, and also see an application for us under the new covenant to make sure that we see everything all the way through. And really, you're going all the way from Genesis all the way through the time that we live in now in terms of new covenant. So make sure we address them that way. Look at verse 1. You'll also understand a little bit of this pressure cooker of a situation that Jesus is in. Chapter 19, verse 1. When Jesus had finished these words, now what are these words? The things that he had just been talking about with forgiveness in chapter 18. He says, he departed from Galilee, so he's no longer in the northern region, and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, and large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. Now, notice the geography. So Jesus is no longer in Galilee, but where is he? He's in Judea, but it brings up even a special place within Judea. Where is it? Beyond the Jordan. In other words, on the east side of the Jordan River. This is a place known as Idumea. It's also a place where there's a man who has jurisdiction there, and his name is Herod. Now, let's see. Does Herod have any interest in what people say about marriage and divorce? What happened to John the Baptist because of what he said about marriage? Even telling Herod about his own Roman law. What happened to John? He's beheaded by his wife and her plan with her dancing daughter. Now, so understand this. The Pharisees have waited until Jesus is right here in this jurisdiction. Because remember, what do they want to see the outcome be with Jesus? They would love it if Herod would cut his head off. They would flat out love it. And so they don't go up to Galilee to ask this question. They wait until he comes into this jurisdiction where Herod is in jurisdiction. Even Herod's brother Philip would be in jurisdiction in parts of it and go, okay, we already know what Herod thinks about people who say things about marriage. The trap is set. You can almost see the Pharisees just salivating for this opportunity. Now, notice what is going on where Jesus is. Anybody followed him? Large crowd of people there. Don't think hundreds, think thousands. That's the way the gospel accounts use that terminology. And what is Jesus doing there? Healing them. So, here's a group of people who are following Jesus out of faith, and all of a sudden when they're coming, Jesus is healing them and taking care of them, and then these dirty, nasty Pharisees show up. Now, I know I bring it up all the time, but I'm not going to stop. Matthew chapter 5, what does Jesus say about the Pharisees? Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. So just know, when they show up and they start asking questions, don't go, oh, well, they must be coming out of a pure motive. Jesus said, unless you're going beyond the righteousness of them, you won't make it. Now, look at their question. The trap is set in their mind. He's in a certain place. If we can get him to say the wrong thing, we can have him put to death. We just got to go be tattletales and let Herod know, and our whole problem could be over. Their perceived problem. what they don't really know is they're looking at the solution. Verse 3. Some Pharisees came to Jesus, and notice what it tells you in particularly. What's their motive? Testing him. Now, usually in a test, there's an answer key, right? Where there's a right answer. But what is their test really about? We just want you to say something that we can take. He says, testing him, and here's their question. And think about this question. Think about where they are. Think about the outcome, what's already happened to John the Baptist. Because marriage and divorce may just well cost you your head in terms of sometimes teaching about it. And so here he is, and here's these Pharisees. He says, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? Now, any surprise that the Pharisees are centering this question around law? They're asking Jesus, is it lawful under the old covenant, under the law? He says, is it lawful for a man to divorce or send away his wife for any reason at all? He says, do you need something in particular, or can it just be for any reason at all? And once again, they're looking at a viewpoint of law, old covenant. So, they're not asking about new covenant, that's for sure. Send her away for any reason at all? I mean, can you imagine being posed that question? Somebody posed you that question. You'd go, why do you even want to know that? Like, and of course, does Jesus know where it's coming from? He certainly does. But for us, we would be like, that's a really odd question. Really odd. I mean, if somebody asked you that question, what would you assume they're looking for? A reason to divorce their wife. We just want you to sign off on what we're going to do. But really, that doesn't seem to be what they're going after. They're Pharisees. They came to test him. They know what Herod's conclusions are on these things. They'd really like to see Jesus be eliminated and killed. So here's a question. Let's see if we can get the answer we want. So, any reason at all? Verse 4. Look at where Jesus goes back to. And he answered and said, have you not read? Oh, boy. He says, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? Now, do you think that was a shocker to them? You think they're like, you know, that's right. God did create them male and female. We completely forgot about that. Do you ever find it amazing that whenever you ask Jesus a complex question, where does he go back to? Scripture and the simplicity of Scripture, right? I mean, these are the most basic things. Now, you think of anyone who has any realistic understanding does not understand that we've been created male and female. Now, I know there are people who want to get away from that, but that's very unrealistic. Now, he says, he asked him, have you not read? And of course, you think the Pharisees had ever made it into the second chapter? You don't even have to get to the second chapter of Genesis. You think they ever made it through the first chapter of Genesis? Now, keep in mind, they don't have chapters. But I'm going, did you ever make it through the first, oh, let's just say 25 verses of Genesis? And of course, their answer would be, yeah. How dumb do you think we are? We'll find out. He says, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? Male, of course, coming first. Female coming second. But you don't know about first and second until you get to Genesis chapter 2, where you get kind of the micro story. In chapter 1, you get day 6 of creation. You get he made them male and female. He made them in his image. But then you don't really get the in-depth story until you get to chapter 2. Now, he says, have you not read? Are you unaware? Are you ignorant? He says that God, whenever he created them, and if you notice, it just says that he who created them, who actually created them? Jesus did. If you remember Colossians chapter 1 and even John chapter 1, anything that's been created that Jesus wasn't a part of as being the Word, everything good, everything. Think about it. Let's go back. And isn't it interesting? Jesus doesn't say, now, whenever my Father and I and the Spirit were creating mankind, have you read that we made them male and female? He doesn't go that far. He knows what their motive is. And then, verse 5, and said, for this reason, what's the reason? They're made male and female. He says, for this reason. For what reason? Because they're created male and female. And remember, created, once again, is in the Old Testament, you're dealing with words about to make something from nothing. This is not the idea of made, like formed and shaped. He says, for this reason, because God made them male and female, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, I want you to kind of notice a couple of things here. A man shall leave his father and mother. Now, is that quoted anywhere under the new covenant? Ephesians chapter 5. Same thing is quoted. So does that principle still the same under the new covenant? That we leave father and mother? Now, let's go back in time. Genesis chapter 2. Are they under the old covenant? There's no covenant in terms of what Moses gave on Mount Sinai. But here is something else. Let's introduce a third covenant. As Amos talks about it, the covenant of Adam. What was the covenant that, I'm going to use Adam and Eve. I know they're not given those names until chapter 3 in Genesis, but I'm just going to use Adam and Eve. What covenant were Adam and Eve under? Okay, it's not don't touch it, because God didn't say that. Don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's the covenant they were under, right? Did they have a covenant relationship with God? They did. If they would hold to that command, what had God promised that he would do? They would never see death. They would always be provided for? Would they still have to work in the garden? Yes, they rule over it. They actually do work, even before they sin. And yet they would always be taken care of. They have a covenant relationship. Are both Adam and Eve willing to follow God in all of Genesis chapter 1 and 2? They do. They do. If you read real closely in Genesis chapter 1, it talks about how that man is created, of course, from the dust. God breathed into him life, and he became a living being. And it says, and God took him from where he was created and brought him into the garden of delight, the garden of Eden. So it was man willing to follow God? Yes. You take woman, who of course is created, formed and fashioned out of the rib of man, and it says that God led her to where the man was. Was she willing to follow God? Yes. And so both of them were following God in a covenant relationship, right? And in doing that, God gave them this command, which is a little ironic because we can easily see who Adam and Eve's father is, but mother? That's a little odd. There's not a mother there. But you see a principle that was laid out for all time. Whether you are here in the garden, even, of course, it's going to be repeated under the old covenant, and it's going to be competed under the new covenant. Pay close attention. He says, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. I just want you to know the tense. And be joined. Is he joining himself? Is she joining herself? You see how it's in a passive tense? Who's doing the joining? God is. He says, leave father and mother and be joined. Here's where God's doing the work. So if you don't have God as part of it, what doesn't really happen? You're not joined. Because it takes a covenant relationship to be joined. He says, and be joined to his wife, and then the two shall become one flesh. One flesh. And of course, that's the physical side of the relationship, the intimate side. Here's the aspect we need to make sure we see. This idea about being joined together, if you look up the Greek word, if you really even go back further into the Hebrew, in the Greek language, when it says joined together, it literally is the idea about one of two things, being glued together. The other aspect that it brings up, it says to be glued or cemented. Oh, what happens when you mix the cement? Can you really tell the ingredients apart anymore? What do they become? One. And notice, who does the joining? God does. He's the one who says, I glue you together and I cement you together. And you have to leave father and mother. Now, I understand the way we talk about daughters-in-laws and sons-in-laws. We talk about them in a way that I know is from a good heart. We think, oh, I didn't lose a son today. I gained a daughter. I didn't lose a daughter today. I gained a son. We kind of use this idea about they have been wrapped into us. Is that the way God talks about it? He doesn't. Now, does that mean we can't love our children anymore? Of course not. But to go, I don't need to be putting my children in a situation where they either have to obey me or be one with their mate. That's where, as a parent, I need to understand that. And so here it is. He says, be joined to his wife, God's point of gluing and cementing this together. He says, and the two shall become one flesh. He says, here they are together. Verse 6. Remember what the question was? Is it lawful? He says, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? Two things that are glued together. If you just pull them apart, do they just go back to being the way they were? No. If things have been cemented together, if you just pull them apart, do they go back to the way they were? Is it just turned into the re-rod and the sand and the gravel? No. It's interesting. We know that here. The Pharisees don't know that here. And they're supposed to be experts at law. Now, notice how this continues. Verse 6. So, why did I bring all that up? So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Intimacy matters. It's not to be shared outside of that covenant relationship. He says, what therefore God has joined together. In case we didn't pick up on it, that it was passive in verse 5, what do you know for sure now? Who does the joining? God does. If you don't have God as part of this marriage relationship, do you really have a marriage in the eyes of God? You don't, with an exception. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. He says, what therefore God has joined together, let no man do what? Separate. So, how does it sound like he's talking about this marriage relationship? Can you just send her away for any reason you want to? What are you picking up on his answer? No. God glued them and cemented them together. They came together in a physical way. He says, they are joined. He says, and you need to understand they are one. And it doesn't mean they always think the same way. But here's the way God sees them. He says, I see you together as one. I've made you one. I joined you together. Now, he's still got more to say. He's not done yet. There's your first big picture. Then, here comes next, verse 7. They're like, ha, 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 he's not doing this according to law. We got him. They said to him, verse 7, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? Remember, their question was about, is it lawful? And you're saying marriage is joined together and should not, no one should separate it. Let no one separate it. He says, then you answer us a question. I mean, they are law people. And of course, who are they going to appeal to? Moses. I want you to think about Peter, James, and John for a second. Who created man and woman? God did. Jesus did. They don't like this answer to start because we've dealt with Genesis. We came to ask about law. And so now, who do they want to bring up? Moses. Peter, James, and John. Had they been up on top of the Mount of Transfiguration? Peter, James, and John? Yeah. Did they see Moses and Elijah there? They certainly did. And what did God the Father have to say about Jesus compared to Moses and Elijah? You listen to Jesus. You listen to him. Now, Peter, James, and John, they already know the answer. Whether they remember it or not, I'm not sure. Going, if you bring up Moses in contrast to Jesus, what are you supposed to do? Listen to Jesus. But what happens if Moses and Jesus are saying the same thing anyway? Now, look at this. Does Jesus know what the law was about? Does she know the motives behind commandments that were given? Isn't that awesome? Here we go. In verse 7, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? Then why did God command it? Moses gave it. And I want you to realize, was Moses rogue in this whenever he wrote it down, or is this what he got from God? He was inspired by God, by the Spirit of God. And so he's writing down exactly what he was supposed to. And you notice this statement here. He says, to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away. Now, I'm going to make you take a step back for a second just to think about law. Did God ever send Israel and Judah away? Did he ever give them a right of divorce? He did. And in Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 6 through 10, it specifically goes through and talks about it. Do you remember why God sent Israel and Judah away? and gave him a certificate of divorce? Because of their adultery. Because of their going after false gods. Because of them no longer being faithful to God. And because of that, what did he do with them? He sent Israel and Judah away. And how far away did Israel and Judah go? They were both taken into captivity. One into Babylonian captivity, another one into Assyrian captivity. And he sent them away because of their unfaithfulness. Now, we think about Malachi chapter 2. What does it say God thinks about divorce? He hates it. He doesn't like it. It's not enjoyable. But is divorce sin? Not if it's what? You're there, I think. Adultery. He says, if there is unfaithfulness, he says, that is different than all these other things that you're bringing up here. Right? Now, you notice here, they bring up Moses, the Pharisees do. And is the old covenant, are those people under a covenant relationship? Yes, they are. They are. He says, why? Notice their real question is not whether did Moses really say this or not. What's their question about? What is God's motive then in bringing up this command? Then why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? Because Jesus has already shown in verse 6, what is the overall picture about marriage? Let no man separate. He says, God has joined you together. You have become one flesh. There's the intimate side of the marriage relationship. He says, let no man separate. There's your overall picture. And did Adam and Eve share in a covenant relationship with God? They did. And of course, did they fail it in chapter 3 of Genesis? They did. And what happened? They were sent out. You would no longer have access to the tree of life because you could eat and live forever. Then, here we are under the old covenant. You see the parallels? Verse 8, only Jesus could tell you this. Other than God himself, about a motive behind a commandment. And I hope we appreciate it. He says, I'm going to tell you why it's there. It's not because God was saying, oh, you know, if you just don't get along, it's okay. No. Because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to send away or divorce your wives, but from the beginning, it has not been this way. So why did God have Moses write it down? Because of what? Hardness of heart. Sure enough, what had Israel and Judah done in the days of Jeremiah? Was their heart hard? And who did it take him away from? The Almighty Living God. And he said, I cannot bear this anymore. He says, for your own sake, I will send you away. Now, is that easy? No. Why did God do that to Israel and Judah? Because of their hardness of heart. They had committed adultery, and God, even though he hates seeing divorce have to take place, does he understand? He says, there are places where, you know what, this has been completely adultery. He says, let them go. Send them away. Now, Let's talk about the flip side of the old covenant. You ever read the book of Hosea? Hosea plays the role of God. And who plays the role of Israel and Judah? A woman by the name of Gomer, his wife, his unfaithful wife. And after they've had three children together, she abandons them. And she goes out to become a prostitute, hires herself out often. It even gets so bad, she's no longer alluring, that she actually pays her lovers to be a prostitute with her. Pitiful. Evil, wicked. And yet, what does God tell Hosea to do? She's going to be auctioned off on the slave block because nobody wants her. You go buy her back. What does that tell you about the forgiveness of God? He forgives way more than 10,000 talents. And I mean way more. And she comes back in. And he overpays for her, by the way. If you read it in Hosea chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. She's brought back in. And you see the forgiveness that's there. Now, why did Moses allow? Because of the hardness of heart. Now, I want you to realize, the hardness of heart is not limited to the one who goes out and commits adultery. The hardness of heart can also be on the one who, whenever they come back and they want to be forgiven, what if they won't forgive them? Is that tenderness of heart? Certainly not. Now, you realize this picture because you probably have seen things in a similar fashion where you have two people who are in a covenant relationship with God. One of them commits adultery and leaves, and then they have a change of heart. And now the one, almost like the story of the prodigal son, the older son who's never left, I always kept your commands. What's he not willing to do? He won't forgive his brother. Oh, it's amazing how unforgiveness and bitterness destroy the heart. And God goes, I'll let the one be forgiven who's come back to me, even though they've committed adultery because their heart's changed. And here's someone who's so hard of heart. He says, I'm not going to make you continue in that relationship. Because in having that kind of hard heart, do you still really have this relationship with the Father? Or have you lost fellowship with Him too? Now, you see what Jesus brings up here. He says, because of your, you notice how he makes that statement? The reason you're asking this question is because of your hardness of heart. Now, there's a couple different layers there. It's hard. Are they accepting Jesus as the Messiah? No. Are they accepting Jesus as the Son of God? No. Are they accepting what God has laid out? No. That's why they came up with this stupid question. Now, sometimes people ask questions and it reveals their ignorance. I don't say they are stupid, but it reveals the ignorance. And that's what they've shown. And whenever you run into people like that, it's not time to berate them. It's time to go, let's look at Scripture and let's see if there's really a heart here. Now, notice here in verse 8, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted, he allowed you to send away your wives. But from the beginning, it has not been this way. He says, you won't find that from Genesis. Of course, Genesis meaning beginnings. Then, verse 9. And then finally, he brings up this one exception. Can you send her away for any reason at all? It's like, you know, she's really not good at cooking the pot roast. He says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, whoever sends his wife away, except for immorality, unfaithfulness. When did man and woman get sent out of the garden? When they were unfaithful to the covenant. The covenant was based around one command, and they left that command away. He blames her, she blames the snake. That's what guilt does. It starts to find somebody to blame. He says, and I say to you, whoever divorces or sends away his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. Because who has God joined together? Those two. He says, so if you decide you just want a divorce for any old reason, and you send them away, and then you go, oh, it's okay, I can marry whoever I want. What's he saying? He says, now you've committed adultery against this relationship. To go on. Now, here's another aspect that we need to make sure we see plainly. Can you appreciate in verse 9, I say to you? Is Jesus greater than Moses? Is he greater than Elijah? Yeah, Elijah doesn't show up in this story. He says, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality, what does immorality do to the marriage bond? It rips apart the glue. It rips apart the cement. You ever seen cement that's been jackhammered? That's what immorality does to a marriage. You ever seen two things that are glued together and then you rip them apart? Do they come apart cleanly? No. They break one thing, shatter another. He's saying immorality will break apart what I've joined together. Now, I told you I was going to show you how this fits into the new covenant. Look over at 1 Corinthians chapter 7 to make sure we understand this correctly and not make wrong applications. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Look at verses 8 and 9. Somewhere along, the Corinthians have asked a question. And the question is, you can look at it in verse 1 of chapter 7. Now concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. It says, oh, it's good not to be married. Verse 2, but because of immoralities. He says, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. Why did God want marriage? Yeah, so that we stay away from sexual immorality. He says, that's why every man should have a wife, every wife should have a husband. He says, now you have a way to be physically intimate in a relationship where God has joined you together, glued you together, cemented you together by his power, and to go, look at the benefits here. He says, some in Corinth were saying, you know what, it's better just not to be married. And some people were going, but I'm already married. What should I do? And apparently they had some kind of misunderstandings about things. And so he says, you know what? But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife and each woman is to have her own husband. Notice it's not wives and notice it's not husbands. One in one. Then, so you start applying this to the people in Corinth, the saints in Corinth, not just the people in Corinth. This is not a general teaching for all. This is about to the saints. Look at verse 8. And if you want to read on your own, verses 3 through 7, fantastic. Verse 8. But I say to the unmarried, Well, look at verse 7. He says, "Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that." He says, and what is he really talking about? I wish everybody was like me. I wish everybody wasn't married. Because we know Paul's not married. He says, that'd be great. But notice the word in verse 7. "Yet I wish." He doesn't say "I command." He says, "I wish." He says, "It'd be great." And later on in the chapter, you can understand why. He said, full devotion to God. Whenever he puts himself in danger, who does he not have to think about? He didn't have to think about his family. He didn't have to think about his wife. He didn't have to think about kids. He can go, "I can be totally in." And he says, "And I know why marriage is in place, because the temptations are there." Then he says, verse 7, "I wish that was great," but he says, "each man has his own gift from God." So when you see somebody who goes through life, sometimes you look at, you know, a 60-year-old bachelor, and you go, "That poor guy." Realize he has a gift. He has a gift from God. And don't look down on him. You wouldn't look down on Paul, would you? Then, verse 8. So now we have to start addressing these different groups within the church. Verse 8. "But I say to the unmarried and to widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I." He says, if you've never been married, it would be great if you could stay unmarried. He says, if you're a widow, he says, here, it would be good if they remained as I am. If they didn't marry. If widows didn't marry. Now, he says, it would be good. He doesn't say, you can't. And some widows who have married other widowers have found that to be very difficult in blending families together. At the same time, look at what he brings up, verse 7. Because remember what marriage is also about. "But if they do not have self-control," fruit of the Spirit, self-control. But sometimes we go, I can't do that. I don't want to live the rest of my days by myself. I still have these physical desires. He says, and I do not want to walk into sexual immorality. He says, but if they do not have self-control, do what? Let them marry. Don't look down your nose on them. He says, let them marry. He says, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. And it's to glow with heat. This is a bad way to say it. I'm going to say it anyway. For those of you who have dogs, when the dog is in heat, they are glowing. You know, oh. And to realize, here's the idea. Sometimes men and women, after they've been married, enjoyed marriage, partner dies, and to go, so what do? And you go, well, you find a mate who loves the Lord, and it's okay to marry. It's good to remain as you are. But if you're like, you know what, this is still not a sin. And he lays it out that way. Now, look at the application, because verses 10 and 11 are the application of Matthew chapter 19 of where we've been. And make sure we look at it the right way. Because now in 1 Corinthians, what covenant are we under? This is new covenant, through and through. And so you realize how the instruction is going here, verse 10. "But to the married, I give instructions." Now, that seems like a pretty easy change, right? But I want to show you something. There's something baked into this. Look down in verse 12. Now, we've already dealt with the unmarried and widows. We've dealt with those who are married. And then you come down here to verse 12, and he says, "But to the..." What? We've already talked about the unmarried, we talked about the widows, and we've talked about the married, and who would the rest be? Who does that leave? Let it describe itself. It'll make it crystal clear. But to the rest I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is a unbeliever. So, you see in verse 12 through verse 16 and beyond, that this context is about a believer who's married to a unbeliever. So what does that tell you about verse 10 when it says, but to the married, who's he talking to? Two believers that are married to each other. Two people who are in a covenant relationship with God. Let's see. Adam and Eve, what were they in? They were believers. They were following God. They were in both in a covenant relationship with God. With what the Pharisees bring up to Jesus, they're appealing to Jesus based upon law. So what are they dealing with? Two people who were under covenant relationship with God, under the old covenant. And now you see here in verses 10 and 11, he said, let's talk to the married, to the husband and the wife who are both believers. In other words, we say they're in Christ. They both had their sins washed away. Do they understand what love looks like? Do they understand what having all their sin removed looks like? They've experienced it. Then notice how he goes. But to the married, I give instructions. Not I, but the Lord. You need to listen to that. That the wife should not leave her husband. Now, it's not raining outside, so apparently we're okay. He says, but to the married I give instruction, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. The wife shouldn't walk away from the husband. He may not be all that you hoped he would be. But he says, he should not. The wife should not leave her husband. Verse 11. But if she does leave, oh, if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. He says, either she has to, they can be, and notice it here, it says, but if she does leave, and you'll notice it, it doesn't say that's a sin. But she puts limits on herself. He says she has two options. What are they? She can remain unmarried. And we go, oh, but what if she has all these physical desires? There's a good way. What can she also be? Reconciled to her husband. And what should he be? Forgiving. And what should she be? Forgiving toward whatever made her leave. Then you realize the picture here. He says, but if she does leave, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And notice, is it different for the husband? No. And that the husband should not divorce or send away his wife. Same pictures. Now here's the problem. We want to take what's here in verses 10 and 11 about two believers who are married to each other. And this is where people make all kinds of mistakes. They want to apply that teaching to everybody. You see how far Paul's gone out of his way to let you know this does not apply to everybody. He says this is about two believers in Christ who are married to each other. He says, you do have options. Can be sent away, but it puts you in a place. I'm going, okay, either remain unmarried or be reconciled. And you realize, and there's all kinds of scenarios, and we're not going to play that game that you start looking at these things with. But I just want you to see this big picture over things and understand, too, as he lays this out, to realize, do you notice Well, real quickly, look at verse 14. This is about the believer married to the unbeliever. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. Notice, if you don't have a believer, do you have a marriage that's sanctified by God? That He has joined them together? Do you notice what He's saying here? He says, without the believing one, is the unbelieving one set apart? He says, if you have two unbelievers, is God going to join them together in holy matrimony? You don't have a holy person present. How'd you ever walk in what's holy if you're not holy yourself? And you realize sometimes people take these principles of Matthew 19, the principles of verses 10 and 11 here in 1 Corinthians 7, and they want to apply it to people who are not even believers. They want to apply it to two people who are in a marriage with a believer and an unbeliever. And what are we doing with Scripture? We corrupt it and we twist it. We pervert it. Because that's not what he was talking about. And so you see the picture here of how he lays this out. And to see the consistency from the garden to the old covenant to the new covenant. And you go, look at what God's doing here. And the beauty of it. God already had things set in place all the way back from the beginning. Isn't it awesome to see how the wisdom of God just brought together? And to go, and if you want to come into a marriage relationship, we'll apply this back to Matthew 18. If you want to come into a marriage relationship and you don't understand forgiveness, not only as a recipient, but as a giver, what's laid out ahead? If you look at the end of Matthew 18, who is that manager handed over to? The torturers. And you realize, this is serious stuff. And to be unforgiving is not where you want to be. And so you see these principles together.